Somewhere in July. It was almost a year from when it was supposed to play this year.
Do you think it's like too early at this point to actually set dates yet? To just for the again, for fear of the risk of having to cancel again or postpone again, that people are actually setting dates already?
I think it's risky. But you know, then they don't want to let that money go. If something was postponed and not rescheduled, they were going to have to give back millions upon millions of dollars.
That's what it is, man. A lot of these bands are so dependent on touring.
Well, the Black Crowes in particular, I mean, they're, you know, they've been off the road forever. I mean, each one has done each brother has done something different and solo-wise, but the Black Crowes as a group, you know, they haven't done anything.
This was a reunion tour? Or was that, did the reunion tour actually happen already?
I don't know if it was a reunion tour. These two they're brothers, and they just got into a huge fight. I'm just glad they hashed it out, and no one died like in Creedence. You know what I mean? There's guys in that group that were brothers that never spoke again for the rest of their lives.
Why am I thinking that? Was the press like acknowledging it as a reunion tour, or was it just me? Like was I imagining it? I'm just kind of thinking like, wait. I remember
it was
you
the anniversary.
About
anniversary of Shaking
the
Money
record? Okay, yeah, that makes sense. All right, because I know there was like some extra attention around this tour, and I remember you talking about it.
Yeah, I just found this out. You know that Rick Rubin produced that record? I never knew that.
Rubin produced Shake Your Money Maker?
Yeah. I was in a conversation.
No,
yeah, I didn't either. I was in a conversation with somebody, and we were talking about Rick Rubin, so I decided to go to like a wiki page for him. I start going through all the records. Obviously, there's big hitters in there that I know. You know, he's done just about every Slayer record. He's done a couple of Eminem records, the Beastie Boys stuff, obviously. There was a lot of obvious stuff that I knew. So I'm just flipping through the list and going through his whole producing catalog, and Shake Your Money Maker pops up, and I'm like, what? Really? Wow. I mean, he was probably at that moment, what was I, like 20? So you're looking at, what, 90? I guess it was? Yeah, 90. He was probably like one of the biggest people on the planet as far as producing goes. Chili Peppers, obviously, he's done that. He's done like stuff for Adele. I mean, the guy is just everywhere. And we've spoken about Rick Rubin at length on the show.
At the time, Rick Rubin, at the time of the Black Crowes' first record, you know, he had done what? The Beastie Boys? He had done the Cult Electric?
Slayer.
He had done Slayer. He hadn't really built that Rick Rubin legend yet, though. I don't think he was still developing his name, you know.
Yeah, I could agree with that.
I had no idea, man. If that was a trivia question, man, like who produced the first Black Crowes album, man, I never would have, it wouldn't have even been a guess.
Well, what gets me is whose idea was it to put on Hard to Handle on there, because that's a cover. I can't remember who originally did it. An old soul song.
Well, these guys are like steeped in the blues, man. Yeah.
Sure.
And the fact that they just like never strayed from that, from the roots, you know, at first you kind of thought, well, maybe they were just trying to jump on the bandwagon because it was that whole retro 60s thing at the end of the 80s where the 60s came back full circle.
Right.
And everybody was suddenly a hippie. And you kind of, you know, I think at first, I know I was, man, people were kind of suspicious of the Black Crowes and that, you know, were their hearts really in that kind of music and that whole scene, or were they just kind of like doing it as a trendy thing? But you know what? They stayed in that mold of like bands like
Stones,
AC/DC, where they just do one thing. And they just do it and do it and just keep doing it, man. And yeah, they were for real, man. Chris Robinson and you know, his brother,
who I can't even remember his name at this moment. It's totally slipping my mind.
I like met him too. I met him once, and I didn't even know who he was. That's the funny thing is I didn't even know who he was.
Well, my thing is that, you know, was it Rick's idea or was it the Black Crowes' idea to slip in that Hard to Handle tune, especially, you know, because notoriously on the Sabbath reunion record 13, which is also produced by Rubin, he had them sit in a room and listen to old Black Sabbath records.
He had Black Sabbath listen to Black Sabbath?
Yeah, he had them listen to their old albums and, like, get a feel for what they were doing. And, you know, and there's a cool picture of him, like, sitting out in the black and white. It was just neat. You know, I like hearing that. You know, catch the essence of what made Black Sabbath Black Sabbath. I told you, and the 13 album was phenomenal, by the way. It's just such a good record.
Mm-hmm.
That guy touches, I mean, what he touches is gold. I think the Metallica stuff, I think he might have fallen. I think he did a Metallica record and kind of fell short on that. Was it Saint Anger? I can't remember. Anybody out there remembers, feel free to let us know on the
Rick
Facebook
Rubin,
page.
He did a Metallica record. So it wasn't Death Magnetic, was it?
Might have been Magnetic. It wasn't a very good record for Metallica. That much I do know.
I think because when they did Saint Anger, they had the other guy in the studio, the one that's in the movie with them. There's some kind
Bob
of monster.
Rock?
Yeah, I think he was on that project, man, because he's in the film. And that film is kind of them trying to record that record.
Saint Anger. Was that before?
Saint Anger was 2003. Death Magnetic was like 2007. Seven or nine.
I saw them on that tour. It was definitely around 7 or 8. I don't think it was quite 9, but I saw that tour. Definitely wasn't 9.
Yeah.
I was in New York. I was up in New York State.
All right, so I'm going to say 7-2.
Yeah, that's probably a good guess.
Good 4-year gap, man. And they already had that bass player, and that was like Death Magnetic was like the second.
Right.
He had been with them, but he came on board right in the middle of that movie. And Rock is still in the picture at that point.
Yeah, definitely was.
Yeah.
Whenever the therapy movie.
Yeah. Speaking of the blues, man, and I this is really the only thing I have because I really, this was, I think out of all of the shows we've done, and this is episode 59, this is the first time, man, that I've come with nothing. I'm just like totally like no ideas, no nothing, just blank canvas, man. But the one thing that this week, man, the Rolling Stones released the big box set deluxe version of Goat's Head Soup. Mm-hmm. Which is, it's a strange album in that it's, you know, critics kind of, they didn't pan it, man, but nobody really loved it. And a lot of fans kind of, you know, they just kind of shit all over it, man. And it doesn't get the respect that it really deserves, man. And, you know, at the same time, it was with a number one album. It had a number one song. It's got like 2 or 3 Stones classics.
What was the number one song?
The number one song on it was Angie.
Oh, wow.
And then you had like some, you know, FM staples like Heartbreaker.
Was Tumbling Dice on that album?
No, Tumbling Dice was on Exile. But I think that, you know, obviously like Goat's Head Soup is, you know, because the Stones had that massive run of masterpiece albums where you have Beggar's Banquet followed by Let It Bleed, followed by Sticky Fingers, followed by Exile on Main Street. Goat's Head Soup, at some point, man, you know, they had to go downhill. And they didn't tour the States with Goat's Head Soup. You know, it just kind of, album just kind of quietly was on the charts and it just kind of quietly disappeared. Mm. And it just fell into the dark depths of forgotten Stones history, I guess, and, you know, underappreciated Stones albums. And it, again, it had the disadvantage and the bad luck of having to follow Exile on Main Street. But, I mean, I've always kind of championed this record, and it's always been, and I know I'm in the minority, man, it's always been my second favorite Stones album, you know, second only to Exile. I think it's that good, you know. I think a lot of it was left off of Exile, and it's kind of fun just kind of listening to Goat's Head Soup, trying to figure out, okay, which songs are actually meant for Exile.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, when you listen to, they a few years later, about 6 or 7 years later, the Stones put out that album, Tattoo You, and it had, you know, it had some massive hits on it. It had Start Me Up, and it had Waiting on a
Emotional.
Friend.
Is Emotional Rescue on that?
Emotional Rescue was the album before it. But it might as well have been the same album because they put out.
Right. And that's why I confused it.
Yeah, because they like between 80 and 81, they put out two records, like almost within a year of each other. And it was just like hit after hit after hit after hit. You know, it was like,
They were definitely in the charts at that time. See, you're schooling me on the Stones here because it's no secret that I'm not a huge Stones guy.
Right. And the funny thing about Tattoo You, which turned out to be a monster album for them, it was kind of like an album of not B-sides, but it was an album of unreleased cuts. So they slapped it together, and it was like the songs from these sessions and songs from the Emotional Rescue sessions and some songs left over from the Some Girl sessions. And yeah, man, 7 years earlier, they had some songs from Go Ted Soup. And Waiting on a Friend was actually recorded for Go Ted Soup. And if you listen to it, I remember thinking like...
That could fit there. I could see that. It's got that old charm. Yeah, it totally does have that old charm to it. I was like Slave.
Slave too. Slave too.
That's a great one. Yeah.
You know, it goes back to some of these songs on Tattoo. You go all the way back to Go Tattoo. And that's why the album sounded so like, and I hate to use the word uneven, but there's a lot of critics use it. It's kind of like a cliche, but Tattoo You, if there's any definition of an uneven sounding album, it's Tattoo You. You got these upbeat songs like Start Me Up and Neighbors and Hank Fire. And then you have these slower, swampy summer heat, dog days of August, disgusting sewage dumpy New York City sounds, man, of like Slave in Heaven and Waiting on a Friend. You know, and Waiting on the Friend was always like this weird song that didn't fit in with the rest of Tattoo You. So when I found out, like, holy shit, man, it doesn't just sound like it belongs on Goat's Head. It should have been on Goat's Head, man. So anyway, I'm just glad that this album came out. I'm glad that, you know, the Stones have kind of, they've been releasing the massive deluxe sets of classic albums. They did Some Girls a few years back. They did Exile on Main Street a few years back. So anybody's guess could have been Sticky Fingers. You know, that would have been the obvious choice. Or even, you know, Beggar's Banquet. But no, man, they put out Goat's Head Soup again. They got some great outtakes. I'm listening to it like the last 3 days. There's no filler, man. Even the outtakes are great. So
Jimmy Page plays on this
song called Scarlet. Yeah, so that's kind of like my big news for the week, man, as a Stones fan and as somebody that's always loved this album and has always been like, I don't take shit for it, but anytime I say, well, yeah, Goat's Head's my favorite album next to Exile, like people kind of look at me weird. You know, Stones fans, you know. So
yeah, I can't stand that. You know, that's a Jersey thing.
Yeah.
Oh, that sucks. This sucks. You suck. Well, whatever. Yeah. You know, music is how you feel. I mean, how does it make you feel personally? It's not, you know, not to mention the hard work that went into to making the record, but it's all about how it makes you feel. You know, people look at me like I'm crazy when I say Animals is my favorite Pink Floyd record, and that
that's my second favorite.
I'm not a huge fan of Dark Side of the Moon. I'm not a huge fan of that record.
That's at the bottom of my list, man.
Yeah, I think it's just watered. It's just a watered-down album for me.
You know, it doesn't mean that I don't like it, but it's just I just rank it near the bottom. You know?
The Final Cut, which is their last record, is better than Dark Side of the Moon. People probably want to fucking hang me from a tree for fucking saying that.
Go
ahead.
No, I was just saying, like, to Nirenberg the last episode.
I've not got to listen to that yet.
I was talking to him. I was just like, you know, like if I like it, man, it's good. That's it. Like if you like something, it's good. And if you don't like it, you know, it's not. So
you stand by what you like. That's it.
That's it. You know.
I mean, I'll go. You know, when I tell people I'm a Steely Dan fan, they either look at me like I got six heads, or they're like, oh yeah, I like them. It's like what? The same thing. Yeah. But like you said, again, you know, we're beating a dead horse. But if you like it, you like it.
Yeah, man. So what else you got? What are yours? You wanted to talk about something that's like Allman Brothers related, or is it something?
Oh well,
like,
yeah, they're kids. The Allman Betts Band. They just put out their second record last week before, something like that. And it is good. I knew the second record was coming, so I had wanted to buy the first one, or not buy it, but download it on Apple Music. So I downloaded that first, and it gave me one song from the new record. And boy, the new record. Betts' kid sounds just like Dickie Betts, man. He just, it, I,
now, whose kids
both,
are whose kids are in this?
I guess it's Greg's. I don't even know too much about them. I guess it's Greg's. I know it's Dickie. One of them is Dickie's kid because he sounds and looks just like him. And the other one must be Greg. I don't know how many kids Greg has. I don't. Mm-hmm. I know he's got the one with Cher. It's not really chat. That was Chastity Bono, girl, boy. I don't. You know. I mean, and I'm not disparaging her for being herself or himself, whatever.
No, it's Chastity Sonny's kid. No. Bono.
Is that Sonny?
Yeah, Chastity. I think Chastity's Sonny's kid, man. Yeah.
I don't know if that was Greg. Maybe Greg helped raise that child. I don't know because she even dated Cher. But they know they have a kid together. Oh, Elijah. Elijah is there.
Okay.
Kid.
Yeah.
Don't know if that's the one on the record or not. I could actually
so
look
it
up
sound
right
like,
now.
Man? Like, what's it? Does it sound modern, man, or does it sound like you got lost in 1973, man? Yeah.
Both. Flat out both. There's some country to it, which I'm not a huge country fan, but the lyrics are good. The musicians are phenomenal. I mean, they got, much like the Allman Brothers, they got like seven guys or six guys in the group, so it fills. However you're listening to it, the music fills the room, you know, it fills your ears.
Nice.
I need more time, I think, with the second record to review it, but from what I've heard so far, it's just, I love it. I think it's outstanding.
Yeah. What else have you been listening to? Anything noteworthy or just kind of staying like, I've just been staying in my comfort zones, man. Just all old stuff, man. Going back and cleaning up all of the stuff that I missed in the past.
Playlist. You know, I'm listening to playlists that I've made for driving, you know, and it's just it's like throw something at the wall and it's stuck, and that, you know, that's pretty much it. I'm not really testing new waters.
Make my playlist, man. I just do nothing but playlists and just like just constructing my own collections of songs, man. You know, I had to renew the lease. Not renew the lease. Like, I had to turn my car, you know, because I lease every 3 years, man. So I had to turn my car in.
Right.
And so I had to get something else. And so whenever I get something else, I get, like, the car has 6 free months of Sirius XM.
Okay.
You know, because I never buy it. I never end up ordering it. So I just get the first 6 months free before it runs out. And, you know, it's like the same shit over and over and over again, man. You know,
it is.
And it's just like, you know, it got old already. Like, I got the car a month now, man. It's ever, and I'm already streaming, like, just syncing to my car, you know, out of just whatever I want to play, man.
The only thing about XM is that you get the same shit every day with no commercials.
That's
you know, like
Q104 is gonna
drop Hello, I Love You by The Doors every day at like 9:30 a.m. followed up by like 8 commercials. Pat St. John will come back on and hit you with Whole Lot of Love by Led Zeppelin.
It's like the same 5 Zeppelin songs, the same 5 Blue songs, and the same 5 Boy songs.
And now what Sirius XM has done has taken a different Doors tune and a different Zeppelin tune, and they've spun it on its head, and you know, just no commercials. However, I will say this, if you're really into a group, you know, they have those special channels, and some of them come, some of them go, some of them have stuck around, which are great, and you can hear good live performances of that act. You know, if they did a Zeppelin one, the Billy Joel one, the Metallica one, the Grateful Dead one. You know, if they not only play acts associated with them, but they play, you know, long stuff, you know, long sets of stuff, especially the Dead, who I've been listening to a little bit more lately, believe it or not.
The Dead?
Yeah, believe it or not. I watched some footage of them when they were in Mexico a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Rob Tobin had turned me on to it. He tagged me in a post or something. And I watched pretty much that whole show, and I was like, oh, okay. Again, mm-hmm. So then you go down that rabbit hole, and I'm finding it because it's easily accessible. It's easily accessible on YouTube. So you found, like, you know, I was finding all kinds of Jerry shows and stuff, and just to see what the lore was about Jerry Garcia. And I think I hate to compare the two, but he reminded me in a way of Clapton, how he made it look effortless. That's the only way that I could compare the two. I'm not saying that they're anything alike because they're farther from each other, but clapped.
Oh, I know what you mean,
and,
man.
Yeah, when she clapped and play and sing, it's effortless, and you're just like Jesus. And I'd like to think that maybe Hendrix would have gotten to that point too, because Hendrix was just so raw.
And that's the thing about Hendrix. I would say that he made it look effortless in the sense that like the footage of he's playing behind his head, man, and he's doing all kind of things just like almost like matter of factly, and he's smiling and he's pointing at the audience, just kind of like, you know, that was effortless is one of the words I would use about Hendrix, man.
Mm.
And you nailed it, man. This was one of the most as far as the charms of a great guitarist, man, is not just talent, man. Can they make it look effortless, man? Can mm-hmm. they get up there and make it look like it's just second nature that it's just as common as breathing, man?
Yeah, you know? And that's and I say Clapton along with Jerry Garcia is because they were both vocalists. And
yeah.
You know, as they're singing that lead, I watched Jerry do it on this YouTube thing. As you watch Jerry sing, he's playing just this really cool little lick
mm-hmm.
that, you know, that's it's not, I don't want to say it's unnoticed because it's totally noticed, mm-hmm. but you're just like, wow, that was just perfection. It was just flawless right there.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept jumping down that rabbit hole.
I love the rabbit hole when it goes, you just go and just peel. It's like the layers of an onion.
You
keep peeling, man. You're peeling the layers, man, and you know, just
you know where I ended up.
When you discover something.
Early Frank Zappa from like England. They were on this show, and just some of the shit that those guys were doing, man. Unbelievable.
Yeah. I explored Zappa a little bit, man. I can't say that I know his music at all, man, but I was exploring Freak Out a little bit when we did that 66 episode a few years back.
Right.
Was that the album? Was it the double album? Like his first album was a double album and whatever album that was, man.
Yeah.
That was the one I was listening to, and it was like doo-wop on there, and it was all kind of jazzy stuff, man. It was like
every spectrum, and you know he's even saying that. It's funny because you can tell he's poking fun at people. He's acting like a maestro. He's got the guitar strapped on. He's acting like a maestro to everybody else in the band. He goes, "Well, we came here tonight, and we know that you people like jazz. So here you go. You got a trumpet player, a sax player, and the fucking guy hitting the tambourine picks up a baritone sax, and he's just blasting out notes."
So how much? Between like your exploration of the dead man and what you're listening to, are you listening mostly to live shows, man? Are you going as deeply as like the Garcia band, or are you sticking with like a certain like period, man?
No period at all. I was just clicking on videos that was live
random
dead.
A
specific song, maybe something a song that I knew or liked.
Yeah.
There was some dead stuff. I would never call myself a deadhead, but there was definitely some stuff that I.
Speaking of Rob Tobin, man, Rob's been like he's kind of like a really good dead historian, man. Like he nails it in the same way that I do, in the sense that Rob has a sense of a timeline, and mm-hmm. where you know, like the other day, like he was talking about the Englishtown show.
Mm-hmm.
And people's memories of it and growing up and how he was a little on the young side to go there. And like, so his memories of it was kind of like living vicariously through the people that did go there and the people that, like
right.
the older kids in his neighborhood. And that was kind of like my first experiences with the dead was the older kids in the neighborhood, like my friends, older brothers and sisters, and you know, the kids that were already in middle school and high school on your block, you know?
Right.
And unlike the Deadheads, man, my experience with the Dead was always the records, the actual studio albums, you know. And while, like, I guess, you know, when we were in our, we're the same age, man. So when we were in our early 20s, like I guess it was the early 90s, my Deadhead friends, that's when they started dropping tapes on me, like, listen to this
right.
show, and this is Palo Alto, and this is 70, this is the 70, this is 73, and this is you know, Fillmore East 71 and
mm-hmm.
you know, the Spring 77 tour, like the magic of the Spring, why the Spring 77 tour was so fucking unique, and all kinds of things. They're just kind of educating me on that, filling me in on all those things that I never even thought about the dead in that way, you know, until that stuff. So, yeah, I've been lucky to know deadheads, man. I was never one myself.
Right.
But, you know, they all kind of had their role, man, part of my own musical.
You know, it's crazy because there was never a Grateful Dead in my house growing up, ever. Nobody listened to it. I grew up fucking, I don't know, 20 miles from Woodstock, from the original Woodstock site. And mm-hmm. Grateful Dead was just never in my house. We were hippies. There were plenty of hippies everywhere. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Crosby, Stills, Nash, that more of like that stuff, but never any Dead. I was never exposed to the Grateful Dead as a kid. Even in the, I guess I started getting exposed to that, like you said, probably about 20, 17, 18, 19 years old. I was still always into my Pink Floyd. And then, you know, I started meeting some Deadhead people. Same thing, actually. It's funny that you say that because I knew somebody who was a little older than me who had experienced some stuff and went down that rabbit hole and was like, here, these are shows from the 70s or shows from, you know, the 80s or whatever. So it was kind of that same thing where he started turning me on to some stuff, and it still didn't really grab me as much. You know, until recently, another good friend of mine turned me back into it. And as I'm older, you got a different respect for things. And, you know, I just started exposing myself to it a little more. And Tobin, we're bringing his name up a lot tonight, but he just pummels you with it. And he just likes music in general. He's one of those guys.
Fan,
one of us.
Big,
yeah, he's
know,
one of
yeah.
us.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he'll pummel you with it. You know, when I was buying bootleg stuff, it was metal bootlegs. You know, Pink Floyd, you know, one of the 14 shows that were in the United States, I had the Nassau Coliseum show on cassette.
You talking about The Wall?
Yeah, which was phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I wish
it's
I still
on YouTube
had those.
Too, man. You got the video.
Yeah, it is on YouTube. I watched it. It was really good, actually. For being shot from, you know, what was that, 1980, 81, whatever it was?
You know what's funny about that? When I was watching the Nassau show, now, historically, man, you go into the timeline, man, of The Wall. It's February. Those shows were in February of 1980. And there's a segment, man, there's a part where they show the TV where he's like, nobody's home, Vera, nobody's home, where
yeah.
Roger's sitting in the chair watching television and you see the TV going. But anyway, I don't know what they did for the rest of the tour, man, or for the L.A. shows or for the, you know, shows in Germany or London or whatever they did. But if you watch the footage of the Nassau shows, man, what's going on the TV? They're showing the U.S. the Winter Olympics, which happened to be going on that week. So
wow.
when the 1980 Winter Olympics at Lake Placid were going on,
that's what he's watching.
That's when Pink Floyd was doing the Wall shows in New York.
Oh wow, that's a great. Now you got me with a good trivia question. That's
yeah.
a great one.
Yeah. So you kind of see footage of.
Was that Eric Heiden?
Eric Heiden and Russioni, man, you know, the hockey
yeah.
team, man, when they beat Russia.
Right, sure.
I think that that had happened about a week before the Wall shows.
Wow.
Yeah.
About that. That's a good piece of history, you know.
Yeah.
I liked watching. I really enjoyed watching that just to see Roger, you know, with the coat. And the different outfits that he was putting on and the construction of the wall. And it was just amazing to see that. The sound quality is fucking horrible. But just to see it
yeah.
in all its glory was just, wow. You know, like these days, let's flash forward. Let's say that record came out last week. Do they mm-hmm. tour that? Do they tour the United States or do they still do it only 14 dates in the States? You know, because now it's more easily accessible. Probably a little more. They can keep the costs down. You know, do they do, I don't know, a run of 21 nights throughout the United States and New York only gets two and L.A. only gets two at that point? You know, it'd be
yeah.
really interesting to see that.
Yeah, the cost, obviously the show was ahead of its time for 1980. I don't know, you know, I mean, if you think about the show and I don't know where I'm going with this, man, but I mean, aside from the wall itself, building the wall, and having these people go up there night after night, it's the biggest ball buster of that show, I would say, would be the timing. Just the timing and having the timely music and having the wall built by the time the band gets to Goodbye Cruel World.
Right.
And have the final brick be put in during Goodbye Cruel World and say, you know, when timed perfectly for when Roger's got his face in that last hole, man, and he says goodbye, and then the final brick closes his face in, and then it's intermission. you know.
Right.
So the timing, like if you notice, man, like there's a in the live version, they had an instrumental that wasn't on the album.
Mm-hmm.
It was called The Last Few Bricks or The Final Few Bricks or something like that. That was the intention of it, was just in case the band got ahead of the guys building the wall. And the music, and they were like about to end the second set, but the wall wasn't totally built yet. That the band would just fucking noodle on this jam, and they just basically keep doing an instrumental and just keep going and going and going until they were sure that the wall was almost built, and then they can. And there was, it was safe enough to go into the little 2 minute, you know, whatever 1 minute goodbye, cool world,
right?
You know, and the live album, the live version of The Wall, when they finally released it, when they finally released it in like 2000 or whatever it was, there's a song called, and again, I'm just paraphrasing, I don't know the exact title, it's called The Last Few Bricks, or The Final Few Bricks, or something like that. And, but yeah, it was a bitch of timing, man. I know like the plane crash, you know, happened
right.
a little bit too soon, and a curtain caught on fire on the first night. And,
they also had to tear all that down, put it on trucks, and get to another city. So it was impossible.
Right.
Whereas staying there for 7 days, they could just leave everything there. You know what I mean?
Exactly. So it was a matter of transport too, right?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, keeping those costs, you know, the costs would have been phenomenal for something like that.
Yeah, because, yeah, and if you think about it, in the 70s, like everything that we take for granted now, man, and where, you know,
yeah.
where the technology is built upon, man, was what was being invented in the 70s, man. I mean, they were creating it in the 70s. It was unprecedented, man. These things
yeah.
didn't happen before. And they were literally inventing it, you know, Kiss's stage show and Bowie's
yep.
stage shows, man, and just with the cherry pickers alone, man. Bowie got stuck in a cherry picker, you know, Mick Jagger, it was all cherry pickers. Like, it literally looked like construction sites. They didn't even try to disguise the fact that they were in a cherry picker. You know, they just you know, shamelessly put it on the stage, man. You know?
And eventually they all got it. And you know, I'll even throw it back to Pink Floyd again, because I saw them in 86 and 88, whatever two tours were in that neighborhood. And they had a phenomenal show. They had the pig was flying around. They had the bed come crashing down. They weren't building the wall,
yeah.
but they had all these props, and it was
mm-hmm.
it was killer. It was just killer stuff that they probably, you know, that they were like, oh, hey, now we can do this. You know, it's all on wires and stuff. My big memory is some dude dancing under that pig, and that pig is floating around the jam, and this dude is just dancing underneath it. It was just insane
mm-hmm.
how good that was.
Yeah, man.
And Kiss got it down to, they got it down to a science, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, Kiss, the Love Gun tour, man, I mean, you cannot overstate the groundbreaking nature of that stage show, man.
Yeah, the enormity of it.
And if you look at it, if you really look at what's on that stage and how they do things, it's so archaic, man. It's, you could actually see the scaffolding, man. You could see the scaffolding
yeah.
in front of the amps, and you could see like the risers, man, are so, it's basically a piece of plywood with a piece of
yeah,
like, steel coming out underneath.
It was like going to see a Broadway show, like that. They have that stuff in the background. I mean, obviously Kiss is just all lit up and fire
yeah.
and everything, but you'd see like those scaffolding with planks. Like I think of like Rent, when they were doing like the upper apartments. Scaffolding,
yeah, and it was meant to look like that. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So yeah, it was really like real primitive, man. And, but at the time, it was groundbreaking, and nobody ever really thought too much about like, well, what's that scaffolding over there? You know, everybody's just like, holy shit! Look at
yeah.
that! You know. So yeah, man. I don't even know how we got on that, man, but yeah, it's amazing where technology has gone, man. You look at Kiss today, man, with the, everything is like LED screens, man. I mean, it looks good, man. It looks cool, but I don't know. It's visually the same thing as listening to digital music, man. I mean, I'm old school, man.
Well, everybody's stripped down now too. Nobody's, you know, there isn't that big rock extravaganza that there was. I think a lot of bands have stripped that down. I think
mm-hmm.
Metallica actually still kind of does a huge stage production. But most bands that I've seen lately, it's not there. You know, Kiss, okay, you're going to see that too. You're not really going to see Kiss just to parade around. But these days, the bands that I'm going to see, I'm not going to do that either. I'm just going to kind of chill out and listen to the live set.
Yeah, well, I mean, Kiss is I'm kind of a weird, I mean, again, in the minority with Kiss, because, you know, like, obviously what you said is true, man. I think most people go out to see the Kiss spectacle, and, you know, they want to see shit blowing up, man, and getting blown up, and they want confetti, and they want to see the whole Kiss legend of the makeup and the explosions and the pyro, man.
And kudos to them for still doing it. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I want to throw that in there. Kudos to them for still doing that for the people who never got to see it.
Yeah, and I as a fan, I would just love to see just one time the original band, no makeup, just in the original band, no makeup, playing their music, man, and just, you know,
the way they started in New York City, just stripped down,
yeah,
and
that's something that the world has never seen, man.
Taking a step further, how about they kind of get into the getup that they first started in, playing those clubs, you know, even as like Wicked Lester, like playing, you know, like the real cheesy side of the makeup, you know, finish it off like you started it.
Yeah, man, like what Rush did in that fine, that last thing where they went back in time and they changed, like, they went back and did every stage set they ever had, right down
to
when they were playing in a gym, and it was basically an amplifier on a chair at the end of the show.
Yeah. You know?
So, yeah, man. But that's, as far as Kiss goes, that's the only thing that the world has never seen. Is the closest thing to that was the MTV Unplugged, where the four guys were out there and they played two songs together with no makeup on. But nobody's ever seen the four of them.
That was 2000, man.
Yeah, they did 2000, man, and like Nothing to Lose.
Nothing to Lose. That's right, Peter Criss. Nothing to Lose.
And
I always remember Peter singing for the Cat Man.
Yeah. I don't, you know, everybody seems to, the consensus is that Peter can't make it through an entire show. And that, you know, that may well be true, but I mean, that's the one thing that they did in all of the variations of Kiss, man, different variations of Kiss over the years, man. We never got just one show of the original four with no makeup, just the music, man. Just go out there in jeans and fucking a leather jacket and play the fucking music, and we never got to see that, man. And with all this, the pandemic thing, man, my hope was that when they did the last show, that nobody would be in makeup, you know?
Right. We had that discussion on the show. We had a discussion about that.
Yeah. But anyway, I just want to mention a few people, man, that, some shows coming up, man.
Hang on, before you do that, I was going to just leave people hanging and not mention any names of people that were coming on, because we got three guests coming up, and I want people to be waiting for that without giving them the, if you prefer though, go right ahead. I mean, our folks out there are starving for shows, you know, the people that listen to us. And if you want to give them the insight to what's coming up, that's totally cool. We'd rather hold off.
We have a few friends coming on.
Yeah.
And I wanted to just, you know, as far as, and the other guest isn't really booked yet.
Right. So, that one, we're still working on that one, but it would be a nice get. It'll be a nice get.
Yeah. But, no, I do want to give a shout out to Joe Jarolski, man, for being patient, because Joe is a guy who we go back with. We go back to middle school. And, you know, his dad used to run Little Joe Records in the 80s.
When you told me that the other night, I got immediately excited. Can't wait to talk to him about that.
And Joe, you know, Joe was supposed to join us on we were supposed to do a Judas Priest episode back in 2018 when we all thought that Priest was going to get the nod for the Hall of Fame. So we were like, you know, come on the show and we'll talk about Priest. And Priest didn't get the nod, I think, you know, and the whole, you know, Joe's guest spot kind of fell through, and we lost touch. And then I saw him again over the winter, and we talked about it. And so we've been trying to put this together to get him on, man, and just rap with him for a little bit. So Joe's going to be joining us in the next month, not necessarily the next episode or two, but I think Joe's going to be joining us, like, probably sometime in October, I think. Yeah, man. Our friend Aaron Novak, who also... Oh, and also, I you know, again, I just acknowledge Joe, man. Joe did help us out with an episode by, you know, he's the guy that hooked us up with Richie Rano.
That's right.
Stars. So, yeah, Joe's met a few people, man, in his time, man. And also our friend Aaron Novak, who is down near Richmond, Virginia, and he has the show Memphis Egypt with Aaron and Todd. It's a really great, eclectic radio show. And those of you may remember, they came to our, they bailed us out, man. They saved our
big time
with our very first Christmas episode.
Big time. That was such a huge thank you goes out to those guys for what they did for us for that Christmas episode, man.
Yeah, so our whole foundation of, this was before we were on, was it before? No, it wasn't before iTunes. We were already on iTunes, but we couldn't put the music up on iTunes yet. But so our only source of getting this out to people,
I thought it was the other way around. I thought YouTube flagged us immediately. First
YouTube
Pink Floyd
did,
song.
Yeah, so we were counting, we were depending on YouTube. So
yeah,
and YouTube, you know, pulled our show down. Well, they didn't pull it. They just silenced it, which is the same thing, I guess.
It was like within minutes. I remember you sending me that text, and I was like, "What? What are you talking about?"
Yeah. So we got hit with a publisher's complaint or injunction or whatever that stopped you, you know. And, you know, one of them came from Jerry Rafferty, who's been dead for years, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think Jerry was aware of it, that we were using this song, but
he's a big fan of the show.
I'm dealing with this kind of stuff with my book now, man. I might as well just use this platform, man, since we have it, man. We have a podcast, so we might as well use the platform to self-promote, I guess, too. You know, but I do have a book coming out, and that's the main reason for, you know, obviously, Rock Under Fire not being around and us recording so infrequently, man. That was all, you know, my fault. And the fact that I just haven't had time to do it, man. I've just been writing this book.
I wouldn't say it's a fault.
It was just a priority, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
Priority.
Sure.
And you know, the better part of 3.5 years I spent doing this, and spent most of 2020 editing, and you know, in dealing with publicists and agents and lawyers and photographers and all of the bullshit, man, that goes, it's like I was saying to you before, man, the writing of a book is the easy part, you know, and it's just what, you know, now I know why people have assistants, man, and secretaries and all the other bullshit, man, because I've never been so busy in my life, man, in trying to get this out, but, you know, I guess I'll talk a little bit more about that in the coming episodes, I guess, man. I'll probably, you know, put the link up for the book
cool.
on our website, man. What was the other thing? So Aaron, man, getting back to Aaron Novak. So he helped us out, man. He put our show up on his show's website, and it was a big 3-hour Christmas episode that we busted our asses on. So we were able to get our Christmas episode out to our listeners. Thanks to Aaron and Todd. And now they've come up across some bullshit of their own, man, in that their show, what I found out, what I didn't know, was at the radio station, WDCE? Or W?
Yes.
I forgot what it was called.
DCE, you're right.
They're running out of a university.
A college.
Yeah. Yep. And when... You know, when you think about it, you don't really think about that too much, man, because you just enjoy the show. And you just kind of take it for granted that they're there and that they've always been there as long as we've known them. You know, and the show's been going on for 10 years, something like that, maybe over 10 years at this point. And so Aaron makes this announcement that, you know, the show's been pulled because, well, because of the pandemic and the closures, that, you know, visitors are not being allowed on campus. And
right.
Their show is considered a visitor.
Yeah.
So
they're not students. Students only.
yeah. So they're not actually closed, but they're closed to visitors. So
visitors,
kind
yeah.
of like, a, you know, you get used to doing that, man. You become a staple. in people's lives, man. And, you know, I'm going to admit, you know, I haven't listened to every show that they've done, and I'm sure that he hasn't listened to every show that we've done. But you know
what? I admittedly haven't listened to everyone. Right.
I've gotten so used to it that it's like, you know, it reminds me, again, just the tradition of Vin Scalzo and Idiot's Delight, man, and things like, you know, Pete Fornatel's Mixed Bag. It's like a combination of all those great DJs that just play eclectic mixes, man. Yeah.
Stephen Van Zandt's Garage. Thing. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Man.
Oh, sure.
So
It's a niche. They carved out for themselves.
Yeah.
And built it. And then, you know, to have that kind of stripped down and stripped away from you, that's
yeah.
Not right.
So
it was sad when I read that.
It's definitely a bummer that he had to break that news, man. But I'm dying to talk to Aaron about a number of things, man. I wanted to do a big episode on vinyl collecting with him a couple of years back. That whole thing fell through, man. So I, you know, connected with Aaron briefly a couple of days ago. So we're putting together an episode with him. So we've got episodes with Joe and Aaron coming up in the coming weeks. And then, you know, we're working on something else. You know, we've got a couple of things booked, so at least we'll have a little bit more consistency than we've had in the past year and a half, man.
I have a project of my own.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that you were kind of hesitant, but if you want to talk about that, I have some questions, bro.
Oh, sure.
If you want to talk about it, go ahead, man.
Absolutely. The sports cards collecting hobby has taken off like a rocket. I honestly think that, you know, COVID kept people in their houses. They started looking into it. I think people on Wall Street actually have sparked it as well with the buying and selling of top-end merchandise cards. Believe it or not, some of the really old stuff still does well. 70s and 80s, somewhat. But the newer stuff, newer rookies, newer prospects, basketball in particular, I saw a card go for $500,000. So sports card collecting has taken off. I've been a sports card collector since the 70s. So you're looking at decades. I started rummaging through my old stuff. My partner, James DiBenedetto, a lot of people who listen to the show might know him. Mike knows him. He just texted me on a whim one night. You collect cards? I said, sure do. And he started talking to me about how it was taking off. So James and I really started putting our heads together, looking at each other's collections. We still have our own personal collections that we're selling separately, but we started making some investment in some cards, and we got some doozies. So we created our web page, created a Facebook page, buying, selling, collecting. You know, sometimes we'll go to people and see what personal collection they're looking to sell, and maybe buy that and flip it. And that's pretty much where I'm at. New Jersey Card Sharks, NJ Card Sharks. Is the name of the Facebook page and website. And, that's where we're at with it.
Newer rookie cards, man, are going for that much, man? Like active players now?
Yeah, to give an example, we got a rookie card in basketball the other day in this thing that's called Case Break. So I'll have to get into that a whole nother time. But we got this card out of a Case Break. The Case Break ends, and literally, almost a minute after it ends, we got two offers for the card for like upwards of $4,000, like in that neighborhood. So I mean, it's legit serious. And the guy was saying, you know, he got deep pockets and he's willing to spend. And this kid's a rookie. It's his rookie card, but it's a one of one. And this card, there's only one of these cards. They printed one of these cards in the world for that series, for that set, whatever. There's one. That's it. Mm-hmm. And we have it. Not yesterday. It was over Labor Day weekend, Labor Day weekend. We pulled one, sitting right in my living room, we pulled one out of a box, another one of one. Dual autographs of these two hottest rookies in baseball, and that card could fetch us a nice amount of money as well. We're getting hits on, like, huge stuff. But it's surprising to me, because you take a kid who's 17 years old, and he's in the Yankees organization. They're already comparing this kid to be the next Mickey Mantle. He throws, he's got a cannon for an arm. He's got the speed for the game. He's Dominican. He's got the best composure. Just a great all-around kid. Rookie autographs, numbered series by his. We have one. But right. I've seen them selling for crazy amounts of money. $1,400. This guy hasn't even suited up in a Yankee uniform yet. It's insane. The baseball, basketball and football, they have taken off so much, basketball in particular. I said that I feel some of these basketball players might be driving the market up by purchasing their own cards. They have basketball players more so than any other sport. All of them have egos. Everybody in sports. I think basketball egos are a little bigger than everybody else's. They have these huge sneaker contracts and stuff like that. I think that they're driving up the market, and they have people buying up their own cards, their own rookie cards, and they're paying these astronomical amounts of money. That's just my opinion. My partner seems to think that it's a Wall Street thing, that they're driving it up. They're putting, they're buying up all these autographs and stuff like that and relics. You can get a relic card that has a piece of the kid's uniform in it with his autograph on the card. It's called a rookie autograph relic. Mm-hmm. And those are just worth crazy amounts of money.
Let me ask you, in particular, I'm thinking like 1979 Topps baseball.
Okay.
All right, so you have, I don't know how they do it, you probably know like a lot of, there's like cards are rated for value, I guess. All right.
Yeah.
So if you see like, Dave Winfield's rookie card, or
not worth as much as you think.
Right. Okay. So, rookie cards that you see that are go for a lot of money. Okay. And then you see somebody selling the entire set for $250.
I would rather have the cards.
Is the person that's selling the cards at the set for $250 clueless, man? Or just unaware that they don't know what they have? Or?
He knows that card is in there. Half the time, he knows that, more than half the time, they know that that card is sitting in that set. One, that card, we'll use Dave Winfield just for argument's sake. That Winfield card is sitting in that set.
Yeah, I just use him as
that's
an
fine.
Example.
No, that's fine. That card is sitting in that set, but is it what's going to drive up the value is not only getting it looked at or looking at the value of the card. They have what they call grading. You send it out to another company and they grade the card.
Right.
Is it center? The biggest thing is it's
exactly.
centering.
Yeah.
How it's cut. Yeah. The corners,
right.
The edges, the print, everything about that card has gone over with a fine tooth comb. It's meticulous what they do.
Right.
So when you get that card back graded, let's say I have that Winfield card ungraded. If I'm not mistaken, I have a Winfield card, so I'm trying to think of the value of it. These numbers are just hypothetical. $30 Winfield card.
Okay.
Raw. That's a raw card. I get that card graded, comes back a 10, could be $300, $200, maybe $1,000. There's cards out there. I have two Dennis Eckersley rookie cards. Most people know him when he was with the A's. He started out with the Cleveland Indians. I have two of them. One could be a huge amount of money. And the other one is not centered.
I had an Eckersley from the Indians, man, way back as a kid.
That's probably the same card I have. It's got that purple border around it. That's his rookie card.
Mm-hmm, probably. I was thinking in particular 1979 because those were the years I was collecting, man. 78, 79, man. When they had like the script writing, man, like the handwriting where it was like...
That's probably where I started. I have cards that made it to the spokes of my bikes. I have some stuff that my brother sold on me. I mean, there's so much stuff that I probably had that is worth so much money right now. It's sickening. But what I still do have is thousands and thousands of cards. Excuse me again. And baseball is very strange in that maybe the guy didn't take off right away. So I'm going through each and every card because maybe it took him 3 or 4 years to become the player that he was supposed to be, and I have his rookie card, or I have a special insert card of his, and I'm coming to find out I have some decent stuff on top of what I'm buying. But I do think I'm looking to sell my collection, believe it or not. So then I'm going to send that to get graded, so that I can get top value for it.
It's not to interrupt, man, but you're breaking up a little bit, man. I don't know if you want to change that. That sounded better. The O sounded better.
Oh, that was weird.
That was good. Hopefully I won't come out too much on the tape.
I apologize for that if anybody's listening. But all I was saying is that I'm looking probably off most of my personal collection, and you know, just start flipping.
Now, what is your collection consist of, man? Were you collecting, like, what sports were you collecting, and what time frame of, like, were you? Did you collect into adulthood, man, or were they all cards from being a kid?
No. I collected well into adulthood. I think I stopped collecting in the probably mid-90s. I stopped.
Wow. So you have, like, all of the 70s and 80s, like, most of the 70s, right? 70s and 80s?
Not all. I mean, I have some good Nolan Ryan stuff, some George Brett, Robin Yount.
Wow.
Some good 70s cards. 80s. You know, also, you got to take into consideration the 80s was a weird decade. There weren't great rookies coming out in the 80s. And, you know, those guys, you got to be a Hall of Famer.
I mean,
it's going to drive the value of the card up.
Yeah, you know, if you can tell me what I'm thinking, man, this will be amazing, man. I wish I had my friend Eric to hear this. All right. If I give you a year, man, roughly you can picture the cards. Or you kind of know? Do you know the cards, man? What I'm talking about, or what they?
Better.
Okay. If I say a name from the Braves, man, 1979, the name Jamie Easterly, do you think of anything off in particular, man? This is just a personal thing with me, man. It's got nothing to do with any, like, collectors or anything that anybody would know, but unless you kind of collected that year, man. And I always wondered this, man, but the 1979 season, man, or not the 79 season, but the 79 card, I bought the entire box off the Carvel truck, man, the ice cream truck, when I was like 9 years old, man. I got in a lot of trouble for it because I spent $10 on Kiss cards and $10 on baseball cards, right? So we bought this fucking box of cards, man. It was like the whole, you know, you basically had the whole collection in there, all right? But in every fucking pack was Jamie Easterly, man. He was like the most out of, like, all the cards and all the doubles and triples and quadruples of cards you had, man. I think we had like 20 Jamie Easterlys, and we were like, what the fuck with Jamie Easterly? Who is this guy? Like, I never heard of him. We never see him on TV. We never see him playing. You know, if you're a Mets fan and the Mets play the Braves, you never fucking see Jamie Easterly. Who is he? You know, and why is this card like every 10th card Jamie Easterly? So anyway, I was just wondering if there's any known card where there's the most cards produced or something. I guess my question is the cards that are produced, man, is there an equal number, or is there a reason or a rhyme or a reason to why so many people get doubles of certain players? Or is it just me? Or is it just my luck?
That was just your luck. That was just your luck, because those are like wax packs or shelf packs, and you will get a lot of doubles in there. You know, it's not going to just be, you know, what you needed to do was buy the complete set, because the complete set is card number one to card number, I don't know, 745. You have every single card that year produced by that company. Now you have Tops, Upper Deck, you know,
exactly.
OPG. So that's what happened with you. Wax packs. I have a box of them. I'm looking at them right now. They're 1988, I think. 88 rack packs. They're in a clear cellophane, and it's a hanger pack. So there was 1, 2, 3 in the clear plastic, and they hung them up on a rack, and you bought them. But I've opened up about, I don't know, I heard that you could get like about $90 per pack. I've opened up about 4 or 5 of them just to see what's floating around in there, and I've got a ton of doubles. Bobby Gritch, and I'm like, what? Why do I want? Who is this? The card's worth 30 cents.
Yeah, Bobby Gritch, I remember. I had his 1978 card with the purplish pink
border.
Handwriting of the, it was like written handwriting.
Yeah. I do not remember that guy, though, that you mentioned offhand. I don't even remember his name now. That's how insignificant he is.
Yeah, exactly. Jamie Easterly, man. I can still see the card, man.
I'm sure there's somebody out there that knows him and you remember it, so it was a childhood memory.
And they probably had a million of his cards, too, man.
My cards from when I first started, the cards for me that I loved the most in the 80s were Ricky Henderson, because he was one of my favorite players.
Mm-hmm.
Cal Ripken Pippen Jr. just because he was so good.
It was 25 years yesterday, man, that he played his record-breaking.
And he broke the record? You know, it's funny. Yeah. And thank you for saying that, because it was just going to lead me into 2 points. That's crazy. One, he saved baseball because of that. Two, if you look at the back of his cards, the later years, they're unbelievable to look at. Because everything, it says, every stat, it says games played. And it's 162, 162, 160, oh, 161. What happened there? Oh, there was a rain out that they didn't make up, but he played in every game that year. They just didn't make up the rain out. 662, 162. It's amazing to see that on the back of a baseball card. Mind blown. Now, here's the way he saved baseball. 94, obviously, everybody knows the World Series. No World Series in 94. Strike season. They didn't play again until April 30th, I think. The spring training started of the following season. Right. Everybody was, like, leaving baseball.
Yeah, without a World Series.
Yeah, and it would have been Yankees and Expos, probably. I was leery about getting back into baseball. I was like, how the fuck could you do this? But the Yankees were still so good. Cal Ripken comes along a few years. You know, he's chasing the record still. It still stood. He played in consecutive games. And you know, people followed that. They fell in love with that. And it just, you know, the president was involved, for Christ's sakes. It reinvigorated people's love for the game and their passion for the game. And I put that on Cal Ripken's shoulders. And the guy was a Yankee killer in the 70s and 80s. You know, we got him a little more in the 90s. But, man, I love baseball for stuff like that.
You're right. And because, you know, and I guess if you're a Yankee fan, it also helped that the Yankees won the World Series a year later.
96,
and then, you know, a couple years later after that, you know, you had the big, everybody was suddenly hitting 70 home runs. So you had McGuire and you had Sammy Sosa. That was the year, you know, McGuire broke the record.
Broke the record, yep.
Yeah.
And
so
Sosa was close. You know, Sosa was close. So I think Sosa hit 66, maybe?
Yeah, Sosa was right behind him, man, for a while.
And McGuire.
Then, McGuire just kind of sped ahead in the last weeks of September, man.
I think Sosa hit 66 that year because McGuire hit like 71.
That was insane, man. It was insane.
It was magical for baseball.
You know, it just kind of started with Ripken, and the second half of the 90s was, you know, all about baseball, man. And I guess it helped also if you were a New York fan, because, I mean, the Yankees owned the second half of the 90s.
Here it is. 94, they were destined. They were the best team in baseball, them and the Montreal Expos. The Montreal Expos were loaded with talent. When baseball came back, those guys got busted up and sent everywhere. So 95, they come back. They make it into the playoffs as the first wild card team, get knocked out by the Mariners. 96 rolls along, they win the World Series. 97 comes, they get beat by the Cleveland Indians, who were a bunch of mashers. And then you had 96, 97, 98, 99.
Yeah.
I mean, you had 98, 99, 2000, 2001.
And speaking of, I mean, the Expos, man, they were like the best team that never got to the World Series. You know, I remember going back as far as, like, you could go back to like 80, 81, where every year you thought that the Expos were going to win the National League East, and Andre Dawson and Tim Raines, man.
Yeah.
And, you know, that whole fucking team, man, they could have contended with anybody, man, in the four divisions at the time. But they just never made it, man.
Tim Raines eventually got the real. Philadelphia was ridiculous in the era.
And you know, Philly trailed them for like most of that season, and it wasn't until the end where Philly came behind, man. And you know, and the Yankees won 104 games that year. You know, I mean, the Yankees were like they in 1980, man. Everybody forgets the 1980 Yankees, but it was one of the most bizarre Yankee teams ever, man. You know, they were playing, like, half their lineup was fucking injured. You had Nettles out, you had Vanilla injured, man. You had, like they're, like, two, three times over, and their backup had backups, and they were still winning games, man.
Yeah. You had an aging Bobby Mercer on that team.
Yeah, and he was kicking ass.
Yeah, he was. He had a good year.
You know, and the Phillies come out of nowhere, man. You know, even the Royals were, you know, the Royals owned the Yankees that year, man. You know, and they couldn't get past KC, man. But, you know, yeah. But that's a little bit off subject, man. But, yeah.
No, that's all right. Because it's funny you mentioned
– in the World Series, man.
It's funny you mentioned Tim Raines because he eventually got his ring as a New York Yankee.
Yeah, that's true, man. That's true. But they had such a good fucking team. They had great pitching, man. They had great hitting, and they just could never fucking pull. You know, either the Pirates stopped them, man, or the Phillies stopped them, or
the
Mets, you know, yeah. You know, and they couldn't even win their own division, man. You know, they would have done it, man, in 81, the year of the first strike, when the season was divided in half, and the Expos won the first half of the year, man. It was a weird season. It was when the Dodgers beat the Yankees in the series.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, man.
That 94 Expos team, though, they probably would have beaten the Yankees. I hate to admit that, but you know, and was the other thing about that Yankee era is that Steinbrenner was suspended. He was out. So
Buck Showalter
and Gene Michael built that core four team. They, you know, the Bernie Williams is the Jeter, the Pettit. They traded for Paul O'Neill, Posada. You know, guys that Steinbrenner probably would have given up for some aging veteran, they were still there, and they built a dynasty doing
so
it.
So it was only there 1 year, right?
No, he was there more than 1 year.
Oh, okay.
They cut him, or maybe he was there in 90, was he? I think he was 94 and 95, I think.
Okay.
Because they let him loose after they lost to the Mariners. And
all right, yeah.
Joe Torre gets all the credit, and Showalter, you know, Showalter could have coached that team to the World Series. You or me could have coached that team to the World Series.
Yeah, because I never really considered 94, man. So, yeah, I guess he was there, man. And Showalter, I always just think of them losing to the Mariners, man.
Yeah,
you know,
it was tough. He signed an autograph for me and my brother one night. My brother had a pinstripe Yankee hat, and they lost to the Orioles. The great thing about that night is, real quick story, is that Paul O'Neill threw out Cal Ripken at home plate on one hop from deep in the corner. I'll never forget seeing that throw live. It was one of the greatest throws I've ever seen, the home plate he threw him out. But the Orioles went on to win, and we're waiting around for autographs. We got Jim Abbott, a couple other guys, and out comes Showalter carrying a box of stuff, you know, like his papers and stuff because they're ready to go on a road trip or whatever. He set that box down and signed that hat for my brother. He goes, "You sure you want this after tonight?" He goes, "You sure you want this after tonight?" And we're like, "Yeah, man, you know, you're our Yankees." And he's just really cordial about it, and just a really cool dude. Really cool dude. Cool time to be a Yankee fan. It was just great.
Yeah. Little did we know, man, what was up ahead.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, you ain't lying.
It was the birth of another golden age, man, and
Yeah. And then they hit a decade of 2010s where they didn't win a World Series.
This is true, man. This is like the RetroSpeak podcast, man.
It was the podcast, man.
It's continuation. But anyway, yeah, the gist of this part of the conversation, man, is that you have a great – I love the sound of this, man. I'm glad you're doing it. A new venture, man, at New Jersey Card Sharks, right?
Yeah, NJ Card Sharks.
NJ Card Sharks. Man, I wish you the best of luck with that. It's,
awesome.
I love old baseball cards, man. I wish I had the money to collect, man. I wish I had the money to buy some of these things, man, because it's just I love that. It's like such a part of my childhood, man. Again, I'm glued to certain particular years, man, but, you know, I'm fine with that. I'll
talk
that stuff. 78 to about 80. Those were my main years of collecting, man, where, you know.
I'll keep that in mind.
I love those cards,
man. For you.
I love those cards. But anyway, are you doing anything other than sports cards, man, or just sports cards?
Right now, just sports cards.
Just sports
cards.
All
right. Football, baseball,
hockey.
Good enough, man. Eventually, maybe we get into, like, the Funko stuff. I mean, we have some ideas about maybe where we want to go, but right now it's basically an eBay store.
Right now we're
trying to make a little bit of money to get a little nest egg going and then go from there.
Right.
I'd love to see us at a shop someplace.
That'd be great, man. That'd be cool.
I was glad that you're actually so psyched about it. I know that you're a baseball guy, you know, just from the RetroSpeak podcast.
I've always loved baseball cards, man. Like I always say, like, if I had like just like disposable income, or just like I had like a hobby that wasn't stuff that I was doing now, man, or just stuff like, you know, I would get into that, man, but I never did, man. This is something that I didn't have that extra passion, you know, to just really dive into it. It was always just part of my childhood that I kind of finally looked back on, man. Oh, man, I remember that set of cards I had. I wish I had them still. You know, it's kind of, it never really went past that, man.
Here's one last thing that's really cool about it, and you'll dig this because of the history behind it. Three of the hottest guys out right now are all sons of major league players.
Let me see if I can guess them, man.
That makes me feel old, but go ahead. You can guess them.
Is Fielder? No, not Fielder. What am I saying? Duh.
He was back a few years.
Oh, three of the hottest. Okay, never mind. Never mind. I can't even go there, man. Go. Go ahead. Tell me.
Three of the hottest rookies, their fathers are ball players. Fernando
hottest
Tatis.
Hottest rookies now?
Yeah.
Oh, Fernando, I can't name any current rookies now, man. Go
That's
ahead.
Okay. Fernando Tatis Jr.
Okay.
Remember bad Fernando Tatis? I don't know if you remember him or not. Vlad Guerrero Jr., Vladimir Guerrero Jr. His dad was Vlad Guerrero, obviously. And Bo Bichette, who was Dante Bichette's kid, speaking of the Expos.
All right, so all these guys, man, are kind of, I was already kind of,
out.
Yes and no, man. I still followed the Yankees, but I wasn't really following baseball. You know, like, so like, I remember Dante, you know, like, you know.
Guerrero was a lethal hitter. Lethal. And his son is just as good.
Yeah, yeah. I guess with that, man, we should probably break with this episode, man. And, you know, look, in the coming weeks, man, we have some really cool guests coming on.
Looking forward to it.
Yes. And I guess with that, we'll see you guys.
Sayonara.
Bad news keeps pouring on me. Bad news keeps